Hello and happy new year, and of course welcome to Rabbiting On. We are just days away from January the 4th when we are going to be marking the 80th anniversary of the Movement for Reform Judaism, which was not known as that then. It's 80 years since six independent synagogues met in the middle of World War II at the Midland Hotel in Manchester. That was back in 1942, and that laid the foundations for what we know today as the Movement for Reform Judaism. I am Rabbi Debbie Young Summers, and of course I'm here as usual with the wonderful rabbis Miriam Berger and Robin Ashworth-Steen. And to help us celebrate today, we are so, so pleased to welcome social historian and former director of synagogue partnerships for the Movement for Reform Judaism, as well as probably every other title that the movement has ever had, David Jacobs is here on the show. Hello to you, David.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure, particularly as this meeting took place in Manchester, and that, of course, is my home city.
And I think David is kind of an icon to all of us who have grown up in the movement, and possibly to some who haven't as well, who will have come across David travelling the country and supporting small communities and speaking for big communities. And just, you know, David has certainly been in my life for many, many years, and it's wonderful to have you here. So this is going out at the beginning of 2022. How has everybody's break been?
It's been all about not having to set the alarm is always as big a break as one, you know, as I need. Just that thing of if a day does not start with the quick, we need to get out to school, quick, we need to start walking. Oh, my goodness. It just changes the tone of the whole day. But the uncertainties around changes in rules and all of that definitely has been sitting on my shoulder.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it's not just our mornings that are that chaotic and pressured. Ours started typically as you go on holiday with illness. So Gabriel had a vomiting bug, but he's better. And it's been lovely, apart from, you know, the context we're living in. But yes, just to have a change of routine and a bit of a replenishment and a bit of time to read and rest really needed.
I'm feeling really conscious through this break of what movies we're allowed to watch this year, because I feel like we watched far too many Santa movies last year and ended up with some really uncomfortable questions from Micha around about March time, where he wasn't sure if Santa was real or not. So we're gonna edit a lot more this year, I think. So David, have you managed to have a particular break at all?
Yes, but not from the history bit. I have been encouraged to look into the lives and the times of the German rabbis who came to Britain before the Second World War and helped create the movement. And I have been exploring some of those men who came, joined the 1930s, and the tremendous influence they had, not just in the UK, because some of them went to places like Australia and helped create the progressive movement there. I swim every morning, and I've had a few days off from that. But on other days, when I'm swimming, I just think of places where I might find further information, which is just fun. Passes the time.
It's lovely to know that your interest in history also serves as relaxation for you. This is going to be another episode, I think, sometime, but I have lots of questions about those German rabbis and why they never mentioned Regina Jonas. But we're going to have to go back to that another time. Rabbi Regina Jonas was the first female rabbi, and all these German rabbis never mentioned her. Anyway, we are not here to talk about that today. That's another episode for another time. But as a historian, we know, David, that you have this incredible mind full of wonderfully useful knowledge that we must preserve, really. We want to kind of make sure that it's all looked after, and your archives at home are incredible. So can you explain for us, why was there a conference in January of 1942, and what was it that brought all those synagogues together?
Well, many of us will have a familiar image of children being evacuated, either on trains or coaches, from the industrial cities out into various places which were considered more safe and away from what they presume would be heavy bombing. The Board of Deputies almost immediately set up a joint emergency committee to look at educational provision. However, the insistence of the chief rabbi on all the material being of orthodox basis and orthodox principles meant that the Reform synagogues had no voice and were increasingly irritated by the public stance of this committee, which was saying, look, we're doing this for the whole community and please contribute financially to this work. And the synagogue leaders at the time, and particularly Rabbi Harold Reinhart, an American board rabbi, felt that this just was iniquitous. You know, you're asking for our money, you're asking for our support, but you're not giving us any voice. And so at the first opportunity, which was the end of 1941, beginning of 1942, these six communities met in Manchester. I suppose Manchester was chosen because it was in the middle of the country, because they had Glasgow and Bradford and the settlement and Aylith and West London. So the people in the south of England travelled to Manchester, and the people from Glasgow and Bradford came from those places too. But there was an acknowledgement by the leaders of Manchester community that obviously their building had been destroyed in the Blitz. It was very close to Victoria Station, and the synagogue was utterly destroyed by fire. Very little was managed to be saved. And Manchester provided the largest number of representatives, but they admitted that we can't take a leadership role. So whilst they didn't actually take a leadership role, they participated. There were at that meeting, I have the figures here, 26 delegates, including 8 women, 14 men and 4 rabbis, 2 of whom were refugees from Germany, the other being American-born Harold Reinhart and Reverend Percy Selvin Goldberg, who had fairly recently, to use Jonathan Magonet's term in the glossary at the back of the current prayer book, changed. He had been brought up and in a traditional home, had gone to Aria College. That's the rabbinic training college in Hampshire, Portsmouth, and had served 2 United synagogues before receiving the call from Jackson's Row, when it was at its lowest point in its history. The building had been destroyed, the community was dispersed, but he came and rebuilt that community, and someone I remember very well.
Was there quite a lot of movement of rabbis between different denominations at that point? Because it sounds like that was an unusual journey.
Well, remember, there was no Liebeck College, so they had to seek in a much wider field. But of course, yes, quite a number of former Orthodox trained ministers served Reform communities. Percy Goldberg was one. I think Reverend Cohen was another at Aylith. And Harold Reinhart, in fact, had trained, by the way, at Hebrew Union College. He was born in Portland, Oregon, and trained at Hebrew Union College and then came to Britain. But before that, say, previous generations in the 19th century, well, of course, most of the rabbis, in fact, all of them, were Orthodox rabbis to begin with, and then changed, to use that term. It's not quite, I don't quite know, we can't sadly interview these people. It would be lovely to know, well, what was the motivation?
And what did they talk about at the Midland? What was the outcome?
Well, what they talked about was the need to bring a concerted effort to provide education work and a syllabus and reformed, trained and experienced teachers to bear on these children who were now spread out. Obviously, if you take somewhere like Manchester in North Wales, for example, places like Rhyl and Llandudno. And the other point that was made was for the first time they could provide concerted effort, but with a unified voice. Previous to that, all the synagogues spoke individually.
Do you think they had a sense that this initial conversation would be going into a much longer term relationship of collaboration? Do you think that at that conference, it was very much they had a decision to be made for that moment? Or was this the beginning of a longer journey that they foresaw?
I would like to suggest both. You have to read between the lines of the minutes, and maybe I'm just holding up now those original minutes for those of you who are listening in audio only. But it's quite clear that at the first point, they wanted to ensure effective religious education for these evacuated children, who, of course, some of those evacuated children were from kinder transport. So young people who would probably have come not just from the Orthodox communities in the places from where the kinder transport started their journeys to England, but they would have come from reform backgrounds in Berlin and Frankfurt and places. So there was an expectation from, I think, particularly Rabbi Reinhardt, who was quite incensed at the iniquity of this situation that had arisen. Reinhardt really felt very strongly that there needed to be this work undertaken. So that was the immediate need. But reading between the lines, you can begin to see the representatives from Aelith, for example. Well, it wasn't called Aelith in those days, the Northwestern Reform Synagogue. People like Mr. Mendel, Sam Rainsbury. Those people, you could begin to see, yes, this can be more than just an educational process we're creating. This can be more the unified voice. This is an opportunity for us to create something more than just ourselves speaking. And I think that comes out very clearly, if I may just read from the minutes. The West London Synagogue said, "We can pursue our own educational program. Of course we can. But it was felt now that concerted effort by the congregations here represented would be of great value for the common good." And I think that suggests to me that they weren't just looking for the moment during wartime, not that they would know how long the war would continue, but they could, 1942 was in the middle of the war. But they felt, I think, these men and women, that there was something greater than their individual synagogues and they should be beginning to talk to each other. And we know that almost immediately, within a few years, there was a youth movement, YASGB, as it was called. Shortly after that, the creation of the Beit Din. So we could see that, you know, there was a momentum created at that meeting to then go on and create these other institutions, these very important institutions.
What would you say the biggest pivotal moments have been within these 80 years of Reform Judaism? So there's been this kind of, we started with an educational bent. What you're saying is it moved into both youth provision and status. You know, I think for us, I'm going to speak for Debbie and Robin and myself, you know, the ordination of women rabbis, thanks to rabbis Jackie Tabak and Julia Neuberger, as kind of beginning that trajectory, are obviously vital. And as you said, the kind of the establishment of Leo Beck College to ensure that we had rabbis who were being created within the image of the movements. But what would you say the kind of pivotal moments of Reform Judaism have been over these 80 years?
We know that we began in a couple of rooms at West London Synagogue. And for many years, that was where the headquarters of the movement were. So we were resident there without our own, perhaps, independence. On leaving that, we moved to Swiss Cottage. And from there, in the early 1980s, the Sternberg Centre was purchased and the beginnings of a movement were then established. So I think that move to the Sternberg Centre and Tony Bayfield listening through the focus groups to what the congregations were saying, we want to feel more confident. Now, that goes back to Reinhardt saying we want a unified voice. We want to be able to say we are here as Reformed Jews with Reformed values and Reformed principles. So I think a turning point, if I may say, in 1992 was that listening to congregations, listening to the rabbis and the leaders of the communities to say, look, we need this voice out there in the media, the radio and the television and newspapers. We want to hear it loud and clear. We want that voice to echo what our feelings are in our 42 communities, however many there were in those 30 years ago now. And I think that is enormously important and significant. But if you trail back from there, we've got, for example, the development of our prayer books, which has been enormously significant, particularly the latest edition, which obviously has the language is inclusive. The source material is inclusive. It has transliteration that enhances people's making it more available to them. And going further back, you would have, as you said, women rabbis. You've got the Leo Baeck College. It was a bumpy ride at times. It wasn't always easy to create such institutions and to have that. I remember I'm old enough to remember that in the 1970s, when the late Lionel Blue and Jonathan were creating the 77 edition, people complained about changing, you know, thee and thou. Oh, you can't do that. It's, you know, well, you can do it. And we did do it. And that prayer book was the beginning of the move towards a more inclusive prayer experience for men and women.
I think our 2008 prayer book is incredible. I remember some older colleagues saying, you know, it's almost as if the Enlightenment never happened. Everything is back in there. But actually the empowerment that comes with that, of allowing the Shlichei Tzibur, the service leaders, to pick and choose their way through the service. And the language is so astonishing. When I go into churches now, I really am conscious of the Lords and the He's. And I, when vicar friends have come to services here, they're astonished by the inclusive language. And it's actually something we should be really proud of.
Yeah, I think I'm finding, I mean, I'm, I have to say, I'm feeling really moved and quite humbled by this conversation. I think partly, obviously, because I'm in Manchester, like our synagogue is at the corner of the Midland Hotel. I often like to go there for tea on a hard day because it's a very glamorous setting. But there's something so humbling and so important about, number one, remembering the context that, David, you've set out for us of the Second World War. Just really thinking about the context and place that we're in as a, you know, as a movement, as a people at the moment as well. But also that it came out from what I'm hearing, and maybe I'm reading into this a little bit, from a moment of activism, of saying there is a problem here of our children not being looked after, or not being our community not being represented. And, you know, talking about the prayer book, and exactly as Debbie was saying, that real moment of being radical and being courageous and being brave and knowing that being together is what it's about. And I think that's absolutely fascinating and really important for us to hear and be reminded of as well. And knowing how we can move things on, you know, representation of women being one, like we're in a different space now, but what we can do in terms of our own identity is really exciting. It seems to me another point that was really vital in progressive Judaism in the UK and for Reformed Judaism was the Leo Baeck College, of training our own rabbis and really hearing what you were saying before about, you know, the movement of variety of rabbis and leadership as well. And also the moving towards naming ourselves as a movement, that shift of independent bodies towards something greater and the semantics and the language about that. So can you talk us through what that looked like and what you think the impact of those moments of naming and identity forming moments were?
Well, of course, the initial description of the six synagogues was Associated British Synagogues, which is quite a curious sort of thing. Then we went to the Association of Synagogues in Great Britain. Then there was a meeting in the 50s or early 60s where they described themselves as the Association of Reformed Synagogues of Great Britain. And then overnight, they dropped the association of and became the Reformed Synagogues of Great Britain. And then more recently, the Movement for Reformed Judaism. And then I think we is the bit in the internet where it's RJUK. But I think those different names that they chose to call the organization do represent a movement in the right direction, to a movement, if you excuse the use of the word movement twice. And I think that the college has a huge role to play for within the movement, because of course the early rabbis were not trained at the Leo Baeck, didn't exist, and they were all of course German rabbis, and they weren't all trained, well, they were trained, but they weren't always, they found it not always easy to adjust to become congregational rabbis, because some of them were, you know, academics. They taught at the Hochschule in Berlin, the training college in Germany. And it took them time to adjust. But it is interesting that two of those German rabbis were represented at the meeting, Bruno Italiana from the settlement and Gerhard Graf from Bradford, who subsequently spent much of his later career in Cardiff. But they were, many of them had PhDs, and it wasn't always straightforward. English wouldn't have been their first language, for example. They had all experienced in some way or other the Shoah, or certainly they would have lived through it, having gone through some very unpleasant experiences prior to their departure. And we here provided a sanctuary for many of those rabbis. But they provided the very basis for those important institutions, such as the court of the Reformed Synagogue, the Beit Din, and then the Liebeck College, all the tutors and all the lecturers there, working on a part-time basis under the direction of Rabbi Werner van der Zyl of West London Synagogue. They would have provided that input into that first generation of rabbis. And then gradually, English-born men, and then men and women, came to the college and provided that necessary impetus. And then if I may just bring in another, you mentioned it a little earlier, I think, someone, about the American Reform Movement and how they have influenced the progress here. And how did that happen? It was when people, well, like me, and then originally, I think, Neville Cecini and Margaret Cecini attending their conventions and bringing those ideas over slowly. And then perhaps obviously in more recent times, more rapidly because of the internet and so on, and Zoom, and having their presence within us. So that's been an influence tool. And also, of course, Israel began to play a role. Mm-hmm. Initially, a much quieter role. There is no mention of the creation of the State of Israel on any publication from that, from 1948, in those early months, April, May and June. You'd imagine, State of Israel created. No, not at all. Some of those rabbis, particularly Reinhardt, not very favourably inclined towards Israel. But obviously, gradually, Israel did become a part, and there has been an interplay with young people going to Israel, and then people studying in Israel, and somewhat of an interplay between men and women coming from Israel to study here and us to study there. So all of those things, and I see that very much as an important development and progress through the years that not only I've been involved with, but the years that I've had the opportunity of reflecting upon through some of the historical research that's been undertaken, not just by me, but people like Jonathan Romaine, for example, who did a considerable amount of work in his book, The Tradition and Change book, which gives a history of Reformed Judaism from 1840, the first section written by Anne Kirshen and the latter section by Jonathan Romaine.
The question that kind of it fascinates me is a question that I don't think we've yet kind of answered within Reform Judaism, which is, was there a question in the earlier days about what it meant to call ourselves Reform Jews? Was there a sense of kind of, this is what we all have in common, this is what makes you able to sign up to be part of the association or part of RSGB? What was the thing that those synagogues had in common? For me, there's a real sense of an understanding of what Reformed Judaism is. But I wonder how many of our communities would articulate it in the same way, or our members would articulate it in the same way as their rabbis. There's always, I think, a kind of a personality challenge there on what makes you a Reformed Jew. And I'm wondering if where that conversation started, and whether we've ever been in a situation where, as however many synagogues, whether it was the 6 at the beginning or the 42 now, we've ever come to a decision on, yes, this is what it means to say we are Reformed Jews.
Fascinating question. I think you have to go back a further 100 years to the very beginnings of Reformed Judaism. When West London was established, it wasn't established, unlike in Germany, where they did call themselves Reform synagogues, Reformed temples, or just temples. Here, they just called themselves the West London Congregation of British Jews. West London, because geographically was where they were. British, because they wanted not to break down barriers between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardi pioneers who created West London. And what were the reasons for them beginning that community? Well, they were concerned with how far they had to travel to get to the existing synagogues. They were concerned about the length and, to use the word, imperfections of the existing service, the inconvenient times that those services were held, the lack of Jewish education. Now, did they identify themselves? Well, we can only again read between the lines. They were certainly pioneers of their Judaism. The Sephardim were in fact the dominant force, which is why even today our Siddurim look more like the Spanish and Portuguese Siddur than the Singer's Prayer Book, because still, and again, Jonathan reminds us of those two influences on the prayer book today. But I think there is more work to be done. And if I can just bring in something I learned from American experience, the Americans talk about working in communities as a three-legged stool: rabbis, staff, and voluntary leaders. Now, I appreciate not all synagogues have all of those, but those that do, if those are working properly, effectively, clearly, enthusiastically together, then the communities will flourish. And for those that don't have all the legs of the stool, then the movement can help provide some of the input to enable those perhaps smaller communities, those without rabbis maybe, to have an effective, if you want to use the word, delivery of service. And that's what the movement can do. You can't do that without a movement. If you've just got even, you know, six communities working independently, which we know they did up to 1942, once those communities worked together, we were much more effective both individually and then collectively, because we provided this unified voice. But also, if one community had a problem, then it could be shared with others and talked about and perhaps resolved, or at least moved forward. And again, if you were having a success story, you had somewhere to share it and hopefully picked up and adapted and modified to meet the individual needs of that congregation.
It's so fascinating, and I'm going to go away and think and reread the book by Tradition and Change. And I've got the little book that I think you gave me that is the history of the Manchester congregation of that I'm in as well. What's really fascinating is hearing that Miriam's point has drawn out that a lot of the things that we were doing were really in reaction to the time of the Second World War, in reaction to the services that were happening or changing geography and all of that stuff. And the real challenge for us now in how do we harness the identity that has formed as a result that we are really proud of, that does represent who we are, and how do we harness that moving into the future? So I guess I've got a question of where do we go from here, apart from, I think, when it's 83 years, we can have a second B'nai Mitzvah in Manchester, maybe have the function at the Midland Hotel. That's what I'm thinking.
Is that when we're all going to the spa?
We're all going to go to the spa, have a great time. So apart from that very immediate future, what do you see, I guess, Miriam, Debbie and David, about the future from now, hearing about our history particularly, and what you've heard in the challenge or the call to action from what we've heard already?
I think there has to be a much clearer understanding of the different roles and responsibilities that those men and women have in communities. And as we all have got some staff, certainly got voluntary leaders, and we've all got rabbis, those we're talking to today, then there needs to be a much clearer understanding of the roles, and then to work forward together and to create what we suppose we today would call strategies for that work to be undertaken. And again, the movement can take a lead on that with a clear message. So when we in 1992, for the first time, ran those focus groups, we would then be encouraging synagogues to run internal focus groups. So say, let's talk to your members and find out what their needs are. And more and more synagogues are doing that. They may not call them focus groups. They're talking to our members, opportunities to hear from them. And now we have many more means of doing that. In 1992, we didn't have Zoom. We didn't need to have Zoom, perhaps, but we haven't got Zoom. Now we can reach out to our members in many, many different ways. And I think also that communities have got very different profiles. Each of our communities has its own specific profile, but there are commonalities amongst those profiles that perhaps, again, the movement can work with. There are certain issues. So I learnt that today that, for example, there's going to be going to talk about mental health Shabbat, also the nearest Shabbat to January the 4th, January the 8th, I think it is. We're going to talk about that. We're going to highlight some of those important issues. And particularly, obviously, during the pandemic, this has risen up the agenda of not in the national psyche, but also amongst the Anglo-Jewish community too. So I think all of those things would seem to me, reflecting on my time at the movement and having since retired, but also having opportunities to do that reflection within my own community, which does try and hear its members as much as it possibly can.
Yeah, I think that's so key, isn't it? The listening within, when we've done that in our synagogue, of course, you hear the particular stories, but you also hear the human story, which everyone in Britain runs through. So mental health, we did a listening project. Mental health came out really strongly as something people were struggling with and not having support. And that point we heard earlier, I think, Miriam, you said it about Reform Jews being represented. And of course, that's one of the reasons why those synagogues came together all those years ago, is out in the wider world that we represent ourselves and also what we have to offer, which is progressive, inclusive, hopefully radical and courageous as well. I think it's really exciting and important to remember.
And I think that sense of what those stories are is also what the movement is. You know, the support that is available around mental health, for example, right? When the movement saw that that was what was needed a decade ago, that's where, you know, staff were put. And I know that when I don't know where to turn, there's a Sharon Daniels who I can turn to and ask those questions of. And I think going back to that original story at the Midlands Hotel of what are the things that we can collaborate on, for me, that's one of the strongest parts of being in a movement, right? It's being able to share those resources, being able to support one another, and aware that sometimes that means we have to be mindful that there are communities out there without rabbis, and that as a movement, we can support those communities even more. And, you know, communities are really diverse. One of the things I learned sitting at head office at the Reform Movement doing education work for 7 years, how diverse our communities are and the amazing creativity that comes out of them that we can then all learn from. And I think the flip side of that is without a centralized, strong movement, it does diminish our voice in the public sphere. And we know we get out there and we represent and we talk to whoever wants to talk to us. But it is about having a voice representing Reform Judaism and the values that are so core to us, that Judaism doesn't look like one thing today and never has. And this is an important part of what Judaism looks like today and that might connect for people to something that they hadn't connected to previously.
Judaism set its mind to creating society. It didn't create kind of synagogues or ritual in the sense that it actually was creating the best form of society. And for me as a congregational rabbi, that's what I feel that we can be looking to do, looking at creating society as it could or should be in a real microcosm. But by being 42 communities who are all saying with our own personality, how do we create society as it could and should be? What's right for us? What's right for our membership? How do we then continue to have this ripple effect that actually you don't change things by changing the mindset or the way that it works within only a very small pool, but rather it's that whole piece of it's about what's then replicated and kind of tessellated and continues and continues. We can really learn from each other when we understand what's going on in other communities. You know, I often think of the movement as the kind of the matriarch within the family, that often when there's a bereavement in a family, what stops happening is that, you know, siblings don't know what's going on in each other's lives because, well, we would talk to mum and mum would tell us what was happening in their lives. And actually it's about, well, how do you then find the relationships between you and the way of conversing between you? And when the movement's really strong, we understand what's going on and the best practice in our different communities, and we're able to replicate that and we're able to stand strong on it. And when it's not, we don't know what's going on in each other's lives, and we're getting on in within our own silo. And what we don't notice is how much we lose from just having that very strong kind of trajectory on our own and not feeling the support of walking that journey with others. So, you know, if we can continue to create society as it could be in Manchester and in Leeds and in Bromley and in Brighton and in Finchley and at Aylith and at Edgware, then, you know, how much of society do we begin to influence and create for all sorts of people?
Does anyone else have a last dream of what they would like to see coming next? What one thing would you love to see the movement do in the next 3 years before our bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, b'nai mitzvah?
For me, it's about confidence and pride, and to be able to look out into the world and have a real sense of who we are, what we stand for, be able to articulate that, and to be able to be very loud and proud about it. And I think that's a big piece of work, because I don't think we necessarily all know exactly what that means and what that looks like, and are not feeling that sense of a pride of what we all stand for, in a sense of that being connected and together.
Although, of course, Jewishly, it was ever thus. We have, you know, we're not very good at being monolithic and all agreeing.
But I don't think it's the same as being the same. I don't think it means we all have to be the same. But I think that there are ways of being able to say, how do we articulate that pride? And how do we say, this is who we are?
Yeah, I think I follow on from what Miriam was saying, and actually picking up a point from that I'm taking from what David has been talking about, which is really working on the we and getting to know each other across the communities, to having, you know, this idea of the focus groups or however we term it, listening projects or whatever. But actually, how do we across the communities get to know each other and have the hard conversations that is, you know, being in community is always hard. Actually, it's full of blessings and beauty, but it's often also really hard work because everyone is so different. But how do we have those conversations across communities? And I would also love to see in the next 80 years us continuing and growing our understanding as being activists in the world and creating real change as a movement within social and economic justice in the UK. I'd be really excited by us kind of all coming together and just saying, you know, child poverty in the UK in 2022 is unacceptable. And this is what we're all going to do something together across communities from Glasgow all the way, you know, I don't know which is the most southerly one, but across the UK, and the power that we would harness in doing that if we really got to know each other deeply in relationship is something that really excites me.
And as you say, Robin, being able to take that issue like they did in that hotel in Manchester and say, this is the issue that together we can change, because we know what action leads to and how powerful that sense of accomplishment and achievement can be.
Yeah. Another deep hope that I have, and something that I'm working on already within community and hopefully across the movement as well, is really to raise the bar on inclusivity and leadership, so that we have in both community volunteer leaders and on across our boards, chairs of our communities, and rabbis and cantors coming up through Liebeck College or coming from America, of leaders across the LGBTQIA spectrum, Jews of colour, Jews of all different types of background and diverse, you know, from across the globe, backgrounds of coming from blended families, whatever it is, but really showcasing within the top of leadership and having as a priority within our communities and movement that that is something we are actively working on and encouraging positively within. In 80 years' time, I would like to see that that's who we are.
That's a wonderful hope, Robin, and really something that we all can work towards. And of course, we began that conversation talking to Yolanda from URJ's Audacious Hospitality Programme. I think there's still so much we can learn from our sister movements around the world in that way of looking at what Reform Judaism is and what we can be.
I would really love to hear David's dream for the next year or next 80 years as well, because a lot of what you've said has already inspired me. So hopefully that will drive some of the change. But what do you see? What's your dream?
Well, I just want to really repeat what I've heard from the three of you, and that's to say out and proud and confident. Those three words, I think, are enormously important, because I'm of a generation where we didn't have out, proud and confident. I mean, I think maybe individually, people in certainly at Jackson's Row, one heard Percy Goldberg, and particularly in his interfaith work. Jackson's Row was the first synagogue to have the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster come and preach. Cardinal Heenan came and preached at Jackson's Row. First time that had ever happened in the UK. Now, that was a sense of pride, but I think it only went as far as Manchester. And I think today, with all the social media and opportunities that there are, we need to expand those opportunities. And if I'm allowed to make some political statement, I think the movement needs to have a new chief executive to be able to sort some of these things out, and soon, because I think there has been, I think one of those legs of the three-legged stool at national level has been missing. I think we've got good voluntary leaders, we've got rabbis, but we haven't got, you know, the, if you want to call it, CEO role that Tony Bayfield played, because that was a very critical change.
Well, it's a lot of dreaming and a lot of hope, and I'm sure that we can continue building. Over 80 years, we've seen incredible shifts and changes and growth, and I think we've also seen increasing pride. You know, I think particularly pride for people who are Jews by choice, and, you know, for many years there was a lot of shame, I think, around Reform conversion and around Reform status. And I think we're beginning to reach a time where we can stand up and say we're proud of who we are, and we're not going to worry about whoever thinks we're not. We're just going to be proud and embrace where we are and embrace our inclusivity and our openness. And I would love to see more of that. I think pride is a great word for us to use today. It has been an amazingly interesting morning. David, we can't thank you enough for sharing just a tiny snippet of all that information that is in your head. I hope that you're going to write a book at some point, David, because to lose this institutional memory would be awful. We are going to continue as a movement and through Rabbiting On to be running events and celebrating these amazing 80 years throughout the whole of 2022. So if you haven't already subscribed to Rabbiting On, it's never too late. You can also sign up for our newsletter at reformjudaism.org.uk. And if you want to get in touch, tell us what you're doing to celebrate the 80th birthday of this incredible meeting that began what today is the Reform Movement. You can email us at media@rjuk.org, or you can tweet us on @ReformMovement. And we will be back actually much sooner than normal on Friday the 6th of January, just in time for Mental Health Shabbat, when we will be talking to MRJ's in-house safeguarding and well-being expert, the amazing Sharon Daniels, who's going to be sharing with us a Jewish take on mental health. We hope that all of you can join us then. I wish all of you out there, and of course David, Robin and Miriam, a very happy new year. David, thanks again from all of us for joining us and for your wisdom, and we are sure we'll be hearing more in the years to come.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Shana tova, everyone.
Happy New Year.